Welcome back, everyone, for Morning Tea. I'm Diane Somerville, and I'm chairing this session. And this session, if you're in the right place, is David Schneider is going to talk about determining the optimal investment and consumption strategy for an Australian retiree. So just a reminder, it's a 50-minute session. David will talk for about 35 minutes, and then we'll have about 15 minutes of questions. So by way of brief introduction, David's CEO and founder of 10E24, a company that specialises in the development of software to derive the optimal investment and consumption strategy for retirees. Between 2005 and 2015, David was the head of research and quant methods at UniSuper, where David had primary responsibility for UniSuper's strategic asset allocation across all of the fund's products. David's team managed two internal international equity quant mandates with over $2 billion in funds under management. Before joining UniSuper, David was a partner at Deloitte. Prior to that, David was the founder and managing director of Actuarial Solutions, the first actuarial consultancy in Botswana. David served on several research and professional bodies, including being the convener of the Actuarial Society of South Africa's AIDS Committee. He's written a variety of papers on the epidemiological, demographic and financial impact of HIV and AIDS in sub-Saharan Africa, as well as four papers on investments. Please join me in welcoming David.
Thank you, Diane, and good morning, everyone. About 18 months ago, I was working at UniSuper, as Diane mentioned, and part of my role there was to assist the fund's financial planners in deriving model portfolios for their clients. Whilst I was doing this work, I started to think about the manner in which a retiree could or should determine their consumption and investment strategy. And the more I thought about it, the more dawned on me how difficult this calculation was. I pictured myself retired, 65, on the beach somewhere, barefoot. And here I am. I've got this stock of wealth. I have consumption needs. I have desires as well. And I'm an actuary. I'm an investment expert. How do you navigate through this incredibly complex space? I knew immediately that the answer must involve some level of adaptation. We need to adjust to experience as it unfolds. But how? How do we go about doing this? And because I was working with financial planners at this fantastic fund, UniSuper, and I must stress that the financial planners I was working with were highly professional, committed, wonderful individuals, and they were trying to do the very best they could for their clients, but my concern was that the tools they were using weren't adequate. So I explored the textbooks that they had studied, and I started to read the academic literature. And the more I read, the more concerned I got. And as a consequence, I started working on this research project, which eventually culminated in the creation of 10E24. So today we'll be talking about how do I think one can go about determining the optimal investment and consumption strategy for an Australian retiree. And what I'm going to do, this is a new presentation, I've never done this one before, is I'm going to start by talking about how advisors typically do this calculation in Australia, and I'm going to introduce two significant errors that I believe is made in the current paradigm. I'll explain a methodology that I believe one could use to overcome these errors, and then give a practical demonstration to show where and how one can improve on the current techniques, and then we'll end with some concluding comments and some questions. So I'm going to use a simple example. The example is Mary Smith. It's a hypothetical example, although I've done so many calculations for Mary Smith, I feel I know her quite well. She's 67, she's very healthy, and she's single. She has a minimum spending requirement of $35,000, and she'd like to, but doesn't need to spend another $20,000 per annum on discretionary items. She's been saving very effectively throughout her life. She may be a very typical UniSuper member, as an example. She has $300,000 in super, conservatively invested. She owns her own home, which is worth, say, $400,000, and she's got about $35,000 in term deposits and other personal assets. She also receives about $17,500 from the age pension, at the current time, which is about half of her minimum needs and about a third of her total requirements. So this is the example we're going to look at, and we're going to start by exploring the problem from the perspective of a financial advisor. And the financial advisor would do the correct thing. They'd start by getting to know Mary quite well. They'd ask her a series of questions, and here's an example set of questions, and they'd score her results and map her to a risk profile, and then based on that mapping, allocate her to a model portfolio, which in this case, because of her answers, she would typically be allocated to a conservative strategy. I mentioned she was risk averse, so it's consistent, like a capital stable type of fund, a 30% in equities, 70% in bond portfolio. Having done that component of the analysis, the advisor then presumes she's going to move into that strategy and assumes an investment return of, say, CPI plus 1 or 1.5% that she'll earn consistently thereafter. And then the advisor embarks on a budgeting exercise to determine how much she can sustainably consume and does this by making reference to her life expectancy. Using standard actuarial tables at the moment, her life expectancy, she's 67, is 20 years roughly, and he adds 3 years to be conservative because she stated she was healthy. He then goes about running a scenario test on Excel. Don't worry about the numbers in the table. They're not important. It's the chart that's important, which shows that if she spends 100% of her discretionary needs, $20,000 plus the $35,000, allowing for the age pension and setting down her home and the like, over time, what will eventually happen is she will run out of money. So the strategy doesn't work. So he'll trial another strategy. Why don't she spend 60% of her discretionary needs? So $12,000 plus the $35,000, her minimum needs. And we see that this strategy leaves a buffer at the end of 23 years. He then sits down with the client and recommends the investment strategy being conservative, which is in line with what she said, and explains that this consumption strategy will last until your life expectancy, and there'll be a buffer of about $300,000 at the end of the projection forecast period. And she's delighted because she's received sound advice. And this is the thing. There are benefits to this approach. The client got to know, the advisor got to know the client's needs. And it appears as though the advisor was conservative. The investment returns weren't onerous. CPI plus 1.5% is not extreme. And he added 3 years to her life expectancy. The other advantage of this approach is it's easily audited, externally reviewed, and repeatable. And for some clients, this is actually quite a reasonably simple analysis to present to the client and to explain what's going on. So that's the current approach. What could be wrong with it? Well, I thought of two possible errors. The first, and this is not just within the advisor space, it's actually within the academic literature space, is that it's frequent, for the investment and consumption strategies to be treated as independent, and they're not independent. And the second is that the advisor ignored tail risks completely. And that's the bigger problem in this particular approach for this particular client. Let's look at the problem of interdependence. We all know that the investment strategy is formulated with reference to things like risk tolerances and feeds into one's wealth over time, and that our consumption strategy, which is based on things like our needs, our desires, our wealth, and access to the age pension, we draw down from our wealth over time. But what a lot of people miss is this interdependence problem. What do I mean by that? Well, the faster we consume, the quicker we draw down our stock of wealth, the shorter our time horizon, our growth allocation should adjust based on our consumption strategy. So our consumption strategy must impact our investment strategy. And similarly, the more we invest in growth assets, the higher our anticipated terminal value in wealth should be, but the more volatile the trajectory. And our consumption strategy should recognize that although there'll be more wealth, there's a lot more volatility around that path. And so the consumption strategy should reflect the fact that there may well be drawdowns in wealth, but that the average wealth levels should be higher. So what we have is an interdependence within the system. Now, if we think back at what the advisor did, he first considered the investment strategy for the client, then determined a fixed return, and from that deduced a consumption strategy. The problem is even worse in academia in many cases. So there's a very famous academic in this space, Moshe Milevsky, who's written an outstanding paper, which is how a volcanite should consume. And it's perfectly rational, and he basically argues that the way a volcanite should consume, this is a person from Vulcan who's completely rational and has no emotions, is to divide their wealth by an annuity value and consume accordingly. But in that paper, he assumed the investment returns were constant. Again, same problem, missing interdependence issues. That's the first problem. The second problem, which is more significant in this case, is tail risks. Start with demography. There are a range of demographic events that can occur, and we can order these according to the financial cost to the household on the horizontal or x-axis. What we can have, for example, is a case where the couple don't survive for a very long time. They die maybe a year or two after retirement. Now, that's unusual, but it's plausible. Another scenario, just left of the average, is to live to life expectancy. This is a negatively skewed distribution, so it's not quite in the center. Another scenario is that one in the couple gets seriously ill and survives for a very long time in that ill state. And another scenario, although wonderful for the individual and for the family, but quite onerous from a financial perspective on the household, is that one member in the couple could survive to 105, for example. And there are hundreds of these plausible scenarios. And the issue is, and this is what I was thinking when I was picturing myself 65 barefoot on the beach somewhere, is that if I'm in this box, I'm not surviving for a very long time, I know what my investment, consumption, and product purchase strategy is going to be. I'm going to invest in cash, I'm going to spend like crazy, and I'm not buying an annuity. Similarly, if I'm in this box over here, again, I know my strategy, I'm buying an annuity and hoping the insurance company doesn't go insolvent. That's my strategy. But we don't know, fortunately, we don't know which box we're going to be in advance. On top of that, there's another area of uncertainty and volatility which retirees face, and that relates to investment scenarios. Now, this, as actuaries, we're all very familiar with. And, for example, this is a great scenario at the top. We have a case where we retire, we're fully cashed up, and we walk into a stock market rally followed by low inflation for the rest of our retirement years. What a wonderful scenario to retire into, but horrifically, there's also the scenario where we have a crash just after we retire, when again, we have all our money at risk, followed by high inflation for the rest of our lives. That's a horrific scenario. I recommend that when we give consideration to this problem, we give thought to and understand the probability-weighted range of events that can happen for the client. That's across both the investment and the demographic scenarios that can occur to the client. And critically, this is something which I think is getting missed quite a lot in some of the work I've seen, the demographic experience is more significant than the investment experience. The consumption strategy is more important than the investment strategy. And I didn't really understand this at first. It was only whilst I was working with the models that I learned from the process. And it actually is quite obvious. If you consume much more than you can afford, you're going to run out of money regardless of your investment strategy. And if you're extremely frugal, it doesn't matter what investment strategy you adopt, you're going to be fine. So the consumption strategy tied to longevity risk is actually the bigger consideration than the investment strategy. So let's try and abstract this through to see what's going on. What we've got here is I've got these range of demographic events and investment scenarios, and I mentioned that one of the scenarios is that both die at a very young age. That's unlikely, but it could happen. But most of the events tend to happen roughly in the middle of the distribution. Similarly for investment returns, extremes can happen, but they're unlikely. And if we color code this and pretend it's a bivariate normal distribution, red is highly likely, blue is unlikely, we get a surface, as I've tried to graphically show over here. And the financial advisor, that Mary Smith example I referred to earlier, what he found was effectively a point very close to the kind of modal point on this bivariate distribution. He looked at a single point on the distribution. Now, it is the most likely point, but it's only a single point. Some of the work I've been seeing lately is where a lot of asset managers, for example, are starting to consider the stochastic investment return scenarios ignoring demography. Now, this is a vast improvement because it gives us a great sense of the range of outcomes, but it doesn't consider life expectancy as a distribution as well. It considers a plane in the distribution, but not the entire distribution. The problem with these two approaches is, and again, thinking back when I was imagining myself to be 65, retired, barefoot on a beach, is that what I'm worried about is poor investment returns soon after retirement and living too long. And we consider how much of that distribution is taken up by these two concerns, we see that it's about 35% of the entire distribution are in the areas that I'm most worried about. And in fact, if I'm in this quadrant, I'm in a lot of trouble from a financial perspective. So tail risks are not sufficiently being considered. And the reason this is important is that as actuaries, we are experts at managing, monitoring, and controlling for tail risks. So what's the recommendation? First, let's define what we're trying to do. We're trying to figure out the best strategy a retiree can adopt. Now, they've got a couple of choices they can make each year. On the one hand, they can return to work. They can change the way they invest, they consume, they can buy a post-retirement product. They can release equity from their home, either by selling their home and buying a smaller home or by purchasing a product like a reverse mortgage. And they can be nice to their kids. These are your strategies you can take each year. Now, I'm going to ignore returning to work. Because at the time that you may need the money, you may not be able to return to work. And I'm going to ignore being nice to your kids. Now, I'm not saying don't be nice to your kids, unless they are like my kids, in which case they are on their own. No, I don't think we should build a strategy in which we rely on our children. I think that's not a wise strategy. So I'm going to ignore those two levers, and I'm going to be left with four possible choices that a retiree can make every single year. How much do I consume? How do I invest? Do I buy a post-retirement product? And do I release equity from a home today or in the future if I've got a home? Four choices each year. And what I'm going to do is, because I specified, and I'm going to spend a bit of detail on this, that demography and longevity and consumption is actually the real lever that's really important for a retiree, I thought it would be good to just explain exactly how I do the calculations on the demographic side. I make use of a multi-state model. This is a standard technique within the actuarial literature, which I stochastically simulate the transition through various health states for a couple, starting at healthy, moving to frail, sick, and dead, using standard transitional probabilities. And within each health state, I'm going to allow consumption to vary, with the minimum spending rising as illness increases, or in the case when a couple is ill, and discretionary spending falling in the event that the couple, one in the couple moves to a passive state or falling even further in an unwell state. So we have levels of spending, minimum and desired discretionary spending, that varies according to a health state, and we're going to stochastically simulate the demography for a couple. And we're going to do about 1,000. The reason for 1,000 is it gives us a good distribution of the range of outcomes that we expect. Here's a single simulation. The bottom bars show the health state over time. So we see that for the first 15 years in this single simulation for Mary Smith, so it's just a single case in this one, in this example, she's active and healthy for 15 years, is passive for a year, and moves into an unwell state for the remaining 10 or so years. The gray bar shows her real minimum spending needs, which starts at $35,000 but rises when she's unwell because of increased health costs. And the orange bars show her discretionary spending, which varies by health state as well. And the present value of this one scenario is that she would require, earning CPI plus 2%, $1.1 million. She has $750,000 and she has access to the age pension, which is currently providing $17,000, but that's just one scenario. Another scenario, scenario two, is where she only survived 17 years, but all of those years were in a healthy state. And we're going to do many of these simulations to get a sense of the distribution of effects that could occur to her. Once we do 1,000, what we can see here is the probability, or the curve of death, as us actuaries lovingly call it, TPX mu X plus T, shown over here, and her life expectancy, the red bar. So her life expectancy is to age 90. The theoretical curve is shown over there, and the blue bars show the simulated, the 1,000 simulated events of what could occur from a demographic perspective. Does that all make sense to everyone? Good, yeah. And then I'm also going to consider the stochastically simulated investment returns. I make use of an economic scenario generator, a stochastic asset model. It's actually a cascading model, very similar to, for example, the Wilkie model. I've contrasted a variety of different asset models to see how they perform. It's actually not that sensitive, but it is important that we have a correctly calibrated asset model that can project future stochastic events, future asset class returns on a stochastic basis. And our mathematical formulation, what are we trying to achieve? What we want to do is we want to maximize the amount that the retiree can spend on discretionary items whilst minimizing the stuff that's important to the retiree. And that's very personal, but it's likely to be things like the probability of ruin, the risk of short-term capital loss, consumption volatility, and for some retirees, it might be the probability of having to sell your home before death. So that's going to be our mathematical objective. By changing only those four levers that we have available to ourselves, the investment strategy, consumption strategy, product purchase strategy, and the release of equity from the home. Let's look at this graphically. This curve here shows the expected spending on average in real terms conditioned on the client being alive over time. The gray bar shows the minimum spending needs, which rise with increasing time because she's more likely to move to an unwell state. And the orange bar shows the average discretionary spending, which falls over time because she's more likely to move into a frail or disabled state. What we want to do is we want to give her as much of the orange bars as possible whilst minimizing the risk of breaching the minimum spending requirements and being wholly reliant on the age pension, which in this example was roughly half of a minimum spending needs. Does that make sense to everyone? Good. So the approach that I'm recommending. Start by selecting a consumption, investment, and product purchase strategy. It doesn't really matter which strategy it is, but a useful one to start with is what you currently invest in, and assume that she spends all of her discretionary desires and doesn't buy a post-retirement product. We start by selecting one. We then analyze how the strategy performs. We run all the investment and all the demographic simulations that could happen to the client and score how well that strategy does. And then we repeat. We find another strategy. So maybe she buys an annuity with half her wealth and recalculate how that strategy performs. And we continue to repeat this approach until we find the optimal strategy for her. And for those of you who studied game theory, this is one of the methods of finding the Nash equilibria. So I've just stolen this from game theory. Before continuing, it's useful to define the type of strategies one could consider. And the first one is a static strategy, one that doesn't vary with time. And that could be, for example, the very popular American 4% rule, where you take 4% of your wealth after ignoring your house, and you consume that rising with inflation. That's a time-static strategy. Another could be to allocate 40% of your investable assets into growth assets and keep that 40% constant over time. We could also have a time-varying strategy. A good example of that would be a lifestyle switching strategy whereby we reduce our growth allocation over time. And another good example, Rice Warner paper made this recommendation, that from age 75 you buy an annuity. I've tested that strategy. It performs extremely well. So that is a good recommendation by Rice Warner. A third type of strategy which would typically appeal to actuaries is a wealth-varying strategy. What we do is we compute a personal funding level for the couple. We compare their wealth to the present value of their needs given their specific age and their conditional health status, and we determine an appropriate or sustainable strategy. And whilst it has fantastic actuarial properties, it actually performs quite poorly because often clients are much more interested in the utility of their discretionary spending, in other words, spending earlier rather than later, and this strategy tends to back-end spending. But the final strategies that are, in my mind, the most effective are the adaptive strategies, strategies in which we know stuff will happen and we adapt accordingly. There is a danger or negatives with this approach. Although it does handle the interdependence problem and it does manage tail risks, the concern with this approach, and I realized this when I was thinking through the problem 18 months ago, is that it poses a tremendous computational challenge. You see, if we're going to do 1,000 demographic simulations, and we're going to combine them, 1,000 demographic simulations, and we're going to combine them with 2,000 investment simulations per year. That's quite a number of simulations that we have to consider, 2 million, and we have to do that over 50 years. And in each year, I'm doing about 1,000 calculations. I have to compute age pension, tax inside and outside of super, a rebalancing strategy, which is actually quite complex. And in fact, just doing a single analysis of a single strategy is about 100 trillion calculations that have to be performed. That's per strategy. If we try and scan through all the viable time-varying, time-constant, wealth-varying, and adaptive strategies, we need to perform about 10 e to the 24 calculations, which is about the same number of grains of sand as there are on planet Earth. So it's a horrifically complex computation. Can it be done practically is one of the questions. The other thing we have to deal with is we're going to be dealing with a vast amount of data. We're going to have hundreds of millions of calculations, and we need to find a way of abstracting that to a point that we can understand them. And what I've recommended is this dashboard. And clearly, as an actuary, I might be good at maths. I'm not going to be good at communicating results, but I'll give it a go. What we have here is this first dial is the risk of a shortfall. So this is the case where you run out of money and you're forced to be wholly reliant on the age pension, which in this example, I'm using a couple, and they're consuming all of their discretionary desires, would be a 46% probability of shortfall, which in my mind would be far too high. In this scenario, because they're spending all their discretionary desires, they enjoy on a utility-adjusted basis 95% of their discretionary desires. It's not 100% because at some point the strategy fails and they're not consuming. They leave about 17% of the present value of their current wealth to their family. They have a capital loss, which I've defined as a probability of losing money from investments, of 22%. This is not the volatility of returns. And they have a consumption volatility of 42%, which is quite high. What we also have here is a new term, a consumption signature, the green line over there, which shows the average, because this is a distribution over hundreds of millions of calculations, of how much they would spend relative to their desired discretionary spending and their minimum needs. What we see is about year 20, they start experiencing problems on average, and by year 25, they've fallen below that minimum required spending level. Every single strategy, every product purchase, consumption, and investment strategy has its own unique consumption signature, or set of dials, whichever someone prefers. So that was the case where this couple consumed 100% of their desires. What happens if they consume 90% of their desired discretionary spending and reduce it by 5% per annum? We can see the consumption signature has changed. The probability of a shortfall is far lower, much more acceptable now at roughly 10%. They don't enjoy as much discretionary spending, but they're still enjoying quite a bit. They give roughly double what they had previously to their children under this scenario. So what we have here now is a means for a couple to compare and contrast different strategies to find the best one for them. So with that background, I'm going to quickly move to a software demonstration. Now, this is always a little bit scary because we do require things like internet to work. And, oh, no, we're in. That's good. No, I'm not scared anymore. Okay, that's good. All right, so what we have is this is a piece of software. This is just a sample as to how the software works. This is a client interface I've written in Windows. Obviously, it would be a web-based application in the future. And what we have is let's pretend we're a financial advisor and we have a series of clients. We're not a very good financial advisor because we've only got 7 clients, so we're not making very much money. But for the purpose of this demonstration, what we're going to do is we're going to go down to Mary Smith, which was that example we looked at previously. And what we're going to do is we're going to see that Mary Smith is 67, 66.9. She's very healthy. She doesn't smoke. Her spending needs and desires are in line with what I showed in the presentation earlier. She has $735,000 in wealth, exactly in line with what I've specified. She invests at UniSuper conservatively over here. She's got term deposit of $25,000. She earns no income because she's already retired. And she has preferences, very importantly. Now, I don't know these numbers. Again, this is a hypothetical example. But in this example, what I've presumed is that her importance of covering her minimum costs is extremely important to her, and I would argue that should be important to everyone. And she's ranked her importance of spending on discretionary items as only being halfway important. She's specified that her importance of leaving inheritance isn't that important to her, but, of course, if she wanted to, she could go in, edit that, and increase the importance of an inheritance if she wished. It is important to her to reduce short-term risk of capital loss, and it's only somewhat important to her to ensure that her consumption in retirement isn't volatile. So what we have is a set of needs for her. And what we can now do is we can run these calculations. And the reason I'm running this live is to demonstrate that there is a way with modern computing power to generate these phenomenal number of calculations very, very rapidly. And we're going to start by selecting the client, doing just a demographic analysis. Remember, that's the 1,000 demographic simulations to see what happens to her from a life expectancy perspective and in her various health states. And the calculation is done over here. This just shows the progress bar, and this shows the number of calculations that have to be done. This was only 800 calculations. It's not a particularly difficult calculation. But as we get more and more sophisticated, the number of calculations will rise tremendously. And the results are that we can see her life expectancy is about 23 years. So the advisor actually chose quite wisely when he added 3 years. That actually was reasonably accurate because I specified she was healthy. But what's interesting is we see that there's obviously a distribution around that. And although it's very unlikely, it's plausible that she could live considerably past 100. In fact, we could see this another way. We can actually look up what is the probability of her surviving to 100, and we can see that it's 15%. That's massive. That is absolutely massive. Now, let's think about that for a second. What the advisor did was he allocated her a conservative investment strategy and then planned for her to extinguish most of her wealth by the time she was 90. Yet there's a 15% chance she could live 10 years longer than that. There's no volatility in the investment strategy, so she's now guaranteed to fail with that strategy in quite a few scenarios where she lives past age 90. We could also consider her health states. This is a standard survival probabilities. So she starts off 100% of the time she's in healthy state, and she transitions into frail and disabled state, and then a dead state. And the median we can see is that it's 23 years. But of those, she's healthy for about 12, frail for about a year, and disabled for about 7. We see each of the individual simulations shown over here, and each of them have a different present value. So in this simulation over here, she would be absolutely fine. For example, she only requires $540,000 to support that particular simulation. That's the demographic simulations. Let's have a look now at a single forecast. So let's repeat the advisor's calculations using this framework to confirm that the advisor got to the right results. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to use a simple forecast. I'm going to use the median investment return and the median demographic simulation. I'm going to maintain her current investment strategy, so I'm going to keep investments exactly as they are. If you remember, she has the home, she's got the conservative investments at UniSuper. I'm going to assume that she consumes 100% of her discretionary desires. Now, if you remember, when the advisor did this, the strategy failed. She ran out of wealth. So let's see what happens when we do this calculation. Sorry, I could consider purchasing a post-retirement product, an annuity today or in the future, releasing equity from the home. I won't for this calculation. And we'll do this calculation. And this is a very simple, it's only 50,000 calculations, done very quickly. And what we can see, that on this timeline, we can see that the strategy fails right about over here. The timeline shows the key financial events that occurs to the client and the key demographic events in this one simulation, the median investment simulation and the median demographic simulation. We can see the client's balance sheet over time. And obviously for a couple, it would be much more complicated, but it's the same principle. We can see the chart, she runs out of money in year 20, which is very consistent with what the advisor found using their techniques. We can see her cash flows, her money coming in, her age pension, her interest, money going out, any debt repayments and the like. And we can go back and we can repeat this calculation. But now what we're going to do is we're going to assume that she spends 60% of her discretionary desires. If you recall, the advisor found that that strategy was sustainable. The calculation is completed, and we can see that there's no shortfall, and that the client does indeed have about $400,000 at the end of the period. So the advisor was right. Except that that's only the median or modal point in the distribution. Let's consider the full range of events that can happen to the client. So what I'm going to do now, so I'm going to repeat the same calculation, but what I'm going to do is I'm going to consider the efficacy of the strategy. What do I mean by that? I'm going to maintain the strategy, but I'm going to consider the 1,000 demographic events that could happen to her and the 2,000 investment scenarios that could happen. So 2 million possible scenarios. We're still going to maintain the client's investment strategy. We're going to assume she consumes 60%, which we know worked for the modal point in that distribution. We're not going to buy any post-retirement products for her, and we're going to do 10 e to the 10, 100 trillion calculations, and I thought that was done quite quickly. And here we have this dashboard. What we see for the client is that she runs into a shortfall 38% of the time. So although the modal point worked, she failed 38% of the time. She enjoyed 74% of discretionary spending. She left a quarter of her wealth to her children. She had some consumption volatility and low capital loss because she was invested quite conservatively, if you recall. And we can see her consumption signature over here. It levels off over there because that's the age pension. And one thing we could also do is we could actually look at the probability of being alive. We can see that when the strategy fails, relates to roughly 40%, which ties in with that risk of shortfall over there. So we see that the strategy that was recommended by the advisor, whilst it worked on average, it failed one-third of the time. But if you recall, the client told us she had specific needs, this one being most important, that she never fails, or she fails under a much lower tolerance limit. So let's go back and repeat the calculation, but now let's do a sensitivity analysis of different time-varying strategies that she could adopt. And we're going to do the calculation. Now, we're going to do 100 trillion calculations, but this time we're going to multiply that by about 350 different sensitivity analysis, which is now completed. What we have over here is we can now move these dials to see the impact of changing her consumption strategy. So that's the 60%. Remember, it's the same results as what we had earlier. Or we could allocate her into growth assets on a more aggressive or less aggressive basis over here. And what we can see is as we vary these dials, she can see the impact of different consumption investment strategies. The interdependence of these strategies is very important. And what you'll notice, and this is very important, is note how the consumption strategy is extremely sensitive, but the investment strategy, whilst important, isn't as sensitive. Again, this is the point I was making earlier. If you consume too much, no investment strategy helps you. If you consume too little, any investment strategy works. So what we have here is a manner for the client to work with the advisor to come up with a strategy that makes sense for them given their needs and preferences. But she did tell us what she wanted. So could we find the very best strategy given her preferences? And remember, her preferences were shown over here. These 5 points that she raised map to these 5 dials over there. So let's go back, and now let's run an optimizer to work out the very best strategy for her, given her needs. And remember, actually, this is the only step that's required. I showed you the process, the narrative that was useful, but the only step that the advisor needs to do is go in and say, find the optimal strategy, given her needs and preferences. So we're going to go in, we're going to find the optimal time-varying strategies. Again, we're not going to purchase a post-retirement product in this example. Oh, what I'm also going to do is, because I'm going to work out the optimal growth defensive split, I'm going to say that she's going to allocate her funds to UniSuper. I'm going to find the products which give the highest net of tax, net of expense returns for her on a risk-adjusted basis. So now it's going to do 10 e to the 15 calculations. What it's doing is it's actually crunching through, and for those who are engineers in the room or have engineering background, I'm using something called the active set algorithm, which is a derivative of the conjugate gradient method, a brilliant optimization technique, to figure out the best combination of strategies that perfectly meet her requirements. And it takes about 30 seconds. It's now finished. What we have is her recommendations, and they're very simple. Based on all that analysis, she should spend about $41,000 per annum. Remember, her minimum needs were around $35,000. She wanted to spend $20,000, so we're recommending $41,000. And she should invest $60,990 in UniSuper's Australian equity income product and $239,000 in UniSuper's diversified credit option. I used to work at UniSuper. I know both these products extremely well. I'm delighted the optimizer found those because I quite like those particular products. And she should maintain her term deposit of $25,000. If we look at what the strategy means on the dashboard, and again, the client doesn't need to see the dashboard, but if they wanted to, what we see is that this strategy over here generates a risk of shortfall of roughly 10%, which I think is far more acceptable than the 37% she saw earlier. She enjoys about half her discretionary spending on a utility-adjusted basis. She leaves roughly half her wealth on average to her children. There is no consumption volatility and no risk of capital loss, or almost no risk of capital loss, and we can see a consumption signature over there. The recommendations that we have is that she wanted to spend, this is inflation adjusted now, $35,700. She should spend $41,000, but the maximum discretionary items that she wanted to buy was $56,000. We see an asset allocation strategy for her, $400,000 in her home. Her cash holdings are $25,000. Her growth assets, which were in the UniSuper Aussie equity income product, were $64,000, and her defensive assets, $251,000, which was allocated to the UniSuper diversified credit option. And we can see the investment switches that are recommended for her from her current capital stable and cash portfolios. And that concludes the software demonstration. And the only final point that I wanted to raise is the conclusions from my analysis thus far. And sorry, I have to get to the end of the presentation because I lost my place. The conclusions are that the standard approach that advisors use, utilizing risk tolerance questionnaires with mapping onto model portfolios and expected returns for each asset classes that are fixed or deterministic in nature, and assuming that clients live to the life expectancy plus 3 or 4 years, is overly optimistic, particularly on the consumption side. Simplistic rules, like the 4% rule, I find tend to be overly pessimistic. The consumption strategy is far more important than the investment strategy, yet people working in the space tend to focus only on the investment component. And it's really important for retirees to understand that there's a tension, there's a trade-off between how much you consume and your risk of shortfall, and making an informed decision is absolutely essential. So that concludes the presentation, and I'm happy to take any questions.
Thanks, David. Is there anyone that wants to kick off questions?
David, thank you very much. You're the highlight of the 2 days for me. And you're saying whether you can communicate, I think there's no doubt about that, so brilliant job. In your 6 needs, you crossed off 2. Is there not another one called be nice to your parents and hopefully they inherit? And have you considered, I see a lot of people who sitting there who don't have capacity, but they're going to inherit. So have you done any inheritance stuff in there as well?
No, there are 3 things I haven't done. Dependent children, inheritance from parents, and I've forgotten the 3rd one. So I haven't done that yet. And it's a tricky thing to model because you've got to now take into account the probability of the likelihood of death and the amount you're going to receive and how the parents are going to attribute that between their favorite children. So I haven't done that, but yes, it could be brought in. One could probably say that in 10 years I expect to receive $100,000 and add that in. Similarly, oh, sorry, I remember the 3rd thing. What I wanted to actually do is bring in some kind of a risk discount rate applied to Social Security. You know, I expect that the age pension is, it's kind of an asymmetric trade-off. This is probably as good as it's ever going to get, and if anything's going to reduce. So what I might do is decay the age pension by about 1% per annum or something like that, to try and be a bit more realistic, or increase tax rates. So I think those are considerations. The other issue is that at Anthony Ash's presentation yesterday, he raised the point about the idea of having a buffer and planning and building that in. That isn't built in yet as well, and that's something I can definitely improve the modelling in. So it's a great suggestion, and I will take that into account.
While we're waiting for someone else to ask a question, can I ask about how cost-effective the calculations are?
Cost-effective in terms of computational time?
Well, in terms of, I guess, to the technology behind doing it all, and you know, how much does it cost? How do you get your efficiency to be able to roll this out?
Yeah, so the 5 tricks to the calculation. Maybe I shouldn't share it, but the first thing is low-level code is absolutely critical. You can't write this in C# or Java, or it has to be compiled. So your only options are C++, Delphi, and if you're mad enough to write in assembly, you could do that. You need parallel processing, and run requires careful sampling and an optimization algorithm. The computational complexity in terms of cost is actually not great. Concurrency is potentially a problem. You know, being hit with more than like 1,000 requests at the same time could be difficult, and that would then scale linearly with the number of hardware. So if it's very attractively used, then it would be more expensive. But you could do this calculation, 12 calculations simultaneously on a standard desktop.
Great.
With a Liquid iCooler and i7 Extreme chip, but standard otherwise. Yeah. Sorry, Gary.
Hi, David. Hi. This is Gary Kemka from Bond University. So I've got a series of questions, but before I ask them, I really like your demographic changes, and that's something I should incorporate in my own research. Utility. So your conversation we had, you mentioned you're using CRRA.
Yeah.
And what is your risk aversion parameter / how are you estimating it?
Okay, so what I'm doing is I'm using hyperbolic discounting. Where I apply utility in the framework is purely around the discretionary spending. So one of those 5 components. What I'd say that retirees prefer to consume on a discretionary items earlier rather than later, because you don't know what's going to happen to your health status or whether you'll be alive. And that first dollar of discretionary spending, that first coffee each year, is much more important than, you know, the last dollar of discretionary spending. So it's more important to be able to travel every second year to see your grandchildren than not travel at all. So the way I do that is I utilize hyperbolic discounting, and my CRA parameter, I believe, is 2 from memory.
For every person?
For every person. And, of course, one would need to consider calibrating this. I have tested a variety of different parameters. I found that it's actually not that sensitive for this phase of the modeling. I agree, though, in your work that it would be far more sensitive because it's over the entire lifetime. But that's something that we could definitely spend more time thinking about.
Yep. The next one was the time-varying investment strategies.
Yes.
And the consumption strategies. So I really like your point about the fact you mentioned that investment strategy and consumption are interrelated.
Yeah.
And one impacts the other. So in my own research, I found that essentially for every age, say at age 65, you're withdrawing 3% of your total income, total wealth in superannuation, which increases to about 11% at age 95. Is that something that you are doing over here?
Yeah, the 4% rising to 11%, whatever it is. Yes, that's built in. So the way I mentioned is a rebalancing strategy that gets utilized, and that was quite complex. It actually is extremely complex because the question is, where do you withdraw your money from first, and which is your most tax-efficient vehicle? I first withdraw the minimum amount from super, then I sell down the non-super assets, then I sell down the super assets, and then finally the investment properties and then the home, if the business has it. That's the order I use, so I do make use of that as well.
All right. Thank you.
I have two questions. Firstly, I wanted to understand how you modelled the different investment outcomes for the home.
Yeah.
A different set of stochastics, yeah. Projections for that.
Very important.
I think it's a big chunk of her wealth. So
absolutely. And it's difficult to do, and there's not much literature on this. I'll tell you the method I used. Okay. It may not be the best method, but I found it gave very reasonable results. I built a cascading asset model, and part of that model was wages, salary inflation. So what I said was that houses got to separate house prices from rentals because most people own their own home, they're not renting it out. You need the rentals from the investment properties. Huh? I said rentals rise with inflation if they have an investment property, but there's a stochastic process around that. And I said houses will rise in the long run in line with average wages. However, a current ratio of houses to wages is around 13 times. Long-term average is around 11. So what I've used was an initial condition where 13 slowly trains down to 11, then stays constant. There's a stochastic process around that, and then rises largely with wages from there on in. There's a massive idiosyncratic risk. There is a question as to whether it's even that, because something can happen to that specific house, which obviously you haven't allowed for. But I think it's a reasonable approach that I've used, and I'll be happy to explore other options. The beautiful thing about this is as long as it's consistent with inflation, it's very easy to add in another asset model for houses.
The second question I had was around the level of increases in essential spending, and whether there was any sort of stochastic analysis about different outcomes there, because there's a range of different health outcomes in particular, which might be sensitive to how you've structured your own insurance products or whether you're in the public-private system, etc. But there's plenty of scenarios where I would have thought your essential goes really, really high very, very quickly, and somewhere it stays surprisingly low or maybe even declines somewhat. So I saw quite a gradual increase, and I wonder whether that was actually just the mean or modal line in a very wide kind of variety of...
No, you're right, actually. That's something I need to work on. I hadn't thought of that. I've increased everything in line with CPI. There's an argument that medical costs rise in line with medical inflation, which could be higher. I need to go back and think about that. I think that's a superb insight. Thank you.
I had a question. So one of the options, as you went through the software demonstration, was to use, I think, guaranteed products or, retirement income products.
Yes.
So when it optimizes, have you got a mode so it would also scan those and test whether they produce better results?
Yes.
And I'm interested in how does that go? Like, does that produce better outcomes?
Yeah, it depends on the preferences and needs. That's a great question. This is really exciting, actually. So because one of the things I found, this is actually brilliant, I found that annuities are not a good buy generally. It's always specific on preferences and desires and needs. But annuities today are not a good buy because they're just too damn expensive. I also found that there's a trade-off, there's a break-even point where the client is neutral to whether they buy their annuity. That's roughly a real yield, long bond yield plus 2%, real yield of 2%. We're way below that at the moment, so it doesn't make sense. What I do find that does work is that from age 75 to age 85, gradually buying an annuity makes a lot of sense. And the reason for this is a variety of things. The first thing is that you know you're alive at 75. Because remember I ran the stochastic analysis and it's by health status. If you're dead, I'm not buying an annuity for you. And if you're sick, I'm not buying an annuity. And if you're frail, I'm not buying an annuity because you're not going to buy one if you're in those states. Only if you're healthy would we buy the annuity. That's the first thing. So that's one of the benefits of running a stochastic demographic simulation is we have conditional information based on health state. The other reason is from age 75 to age 85, you're effectively getting a mortality credit that roughly equals the equity risk premium. So you swapped equities to buy bonds plus a annuity, giving you the mortality risk premium. So I find that you have additional information and you're switching out from a higher yielding but more volatile asset to a very stable asset. And it does depend on preference, but I do find the model does quite like those types of strategies. Does that answer your question? Thanks, Jim.
My question was actually very, Mike Murphy's my name, my question was actually very similar, and I'm not quite sure whether you've answered or not. If you have, it's gone over my head perhaps. But it was, how are you pricing the product purchases?
Yes.
And you've identified long-term at two, so is there some model that scales down from current firms to CPI plus two?
Yes, so what I try and do is pretend that I'm the pricing actuary for a life office. I used to be one. It's a very glamorous role. No, I'm just joking. Actually, it is quite a glamorous role. And what I try and do is presume a pricing basis, and then what I do is I model long bond yields, and then I apply that basis and credit spreads at that point in time based on the then modelled, simulated long bond yield and credit spread.
Chris Seddon, thank you very much. It was a wonderful presentation. I'm very interested in your conclusion about the consumption strategy being more important than chosen investment strategy. I think that's a very, very significant conclusion. All of this is based upon a person being able to identify what is their desired, or what is their sort of minimum requirement and what is their discretionary requirement. So this is an incredibly complex model. I think it's actually something that needs to happen before that, and that's a little thing called a person sitting down and trying to budget. And the reason that a person doesn't know what their future spending needs are is because most people don't know what they actually spend today. So somewhere in advance of this, there's a little input sheet which needs to say, please work out what you actually need and what you therefore need to spend. And then they can go into something like this, which will be fantastic.
Absolutely agree. So whenever you speak to financial advisors, they always say, sorry, Chris, you're 100% right. But they always say the first thing they have to do is figure out a budgeting exercise because no one has a clue. That's exactly, they mirror your exact comment. The other point I'd add is it's not just the current minimum and desired discretionary spending. We really don't have much information around spending in disabled and frail states. So work is required there as well. There's no doubt that more work is required. I'm trying to develop a framework and a logic of thinking that given we knew those inputs, how would we solve it? But there's definitely a challenge. And the other issue is how do we actually get those preference ratings? Those are also quite tricky. So there are challenges, but I believe that this is a step in the right direction in trying to give the client a much richer output so they can better understand the consequences of their decisions.
Okay, we've run out of time, so just a reminder to fill in your feedback. Please join me in thanking David.